WF, Bill Minor, MINOR, Jackson Bureau Chief, New Orleans Times Picayune, March 25th, 1974.
That's right, you are one of the few listeners. You've been covering Mississippi since before the Dixiecrat convention.
Yeah.
What, did you just start it here?
Yeah, my first assignment. Yeah, the Dixiecrats really started here.
I mean, did you just start here then?
No. See, I worked for the Picayune. I was in Tulane. I worked for them in 42. That was my last year Tulane while I was in school. And then I went in graduated, went in the Navy, and then came back after the war. And then I worked in New Orleans before I came up here. And I came here in 47. And they'd always been a bureau here. I came in August of 47. My first assignment was the funeral of Theodore G. Bilbo. So I'm in my career went from that. You saw Bilbo's statue, did you? Know?
Is that life-size, Bilbo?
That is larger than life-size.
Really?
Isn't that a monstrosity, though? I mean, it really is. He was a little bit short shit, you know. But that's an ugly statue. It was done by some German sculptor, and I think he did it with a vengeance or something.
It's gross. It looks like he's about ready to give somebody a finger.
It is the, I think it's symbolic. The day that that statue's moved out of there, I think Mississippi will have made the turn completely, I mean, really, because I think that's still...
Why is it still there? I mean, it's obvious it's an ugly piece of work.
The reason why is because the Secretary of State, who is the custodian of the building, was a Bilbo file, and he thinks Theodore Bilbo was just the greatest, you see, and he's the guy who put the thing there. They had it stuck in a corner way down at the end of the hall there, in what they call the Hall of Governors. They had portraits all around the end of the hall, and they had this thing stuck away in a little niche where you wouldn't see it too much, but they had a move that out of there and move it someplace else. So he puts the thing right squat in the middle of the rotunda there. You know.
What do you think it's symbolic of?
Well, I mean, this I think is an anchor to the past of Mississippi. I think this is the last vestige, I would say, of, you know, of reluctance to change and accept the dynamic changes of the 60s and the 70s. It's kind of it's a throwback too. I mean, it's so much of a memory of of the old political ways and few people in Mississippi really, I mean, anymore, you know, think of Bilbo, I mean, except in the most, you know, derogatory terms. It's part of the past that the people would like to forget, you see, and yet it stands out. I mean, he stands out there still as a symbol, you know, of the past that they really want to forget. I mean, if you took a popularity poll on whether to move the statue, I think they would move the statue. But this guy who was the Secretary of State, he was like 70 years old, you see, and he's still...
But do you think Bilbo's image in Mississippi today is one of... causes what, embarrassment or what?
Yeah, I think it is. I would say by and large that's what would be the proper term. I mean, because I mean it is a part of the past that they prefer to forget. I mean, the same, you know, we've having that more recently on with Ross Barnett. I mean, you know, there's no defense, you know, of Ross Barnett's stance in the Meredith case.
He was, of course, repudiated at the polls.
Yes, right? That's right, yeah.
Bill, how would you summarize this whole period? You've been through the whole thing. Well, in summary, what is Mississippi like today politically compared with when you got here?
Well, politically, the state has not matured nearly as much as it has in race relations and human relations. I mean, I think the state is still naive politically to the point that I think they still nurture the desire to reconstruct the old Confederacy, at least politically so, you know. I mean, it's not in the sense of, you know, being able to turn back the clock and civil rights or anything else, but there's still a great deal that, you know, standalone philosophy that, I mean, you can look back at every time the state has had an opportunity to go for something, you know, a third choice, you see, I mean, as latest in 68, you see, when that was Wallace's race, wasn't it? Okay. Well, 68, 64, 60, well, the state had bolted the Democratic ticket, it bolted 4 out of the last 6 elections, you see. And this is what it all started about, you see, in 1948, was, you know, the idea that, you know, the state had been, you know, the most loyal, most democratic state of all, you know, and stayed with the party through Al Smith and through Franklin Roosevelt and so on, and that the state didn't owe anything to the Democratic Party anymore, that they had been loyal throughout all these years. And actually, the average guy in Mississippi, the redneck, or the guy at the forks of the creek, you know, who decide political decisions in Mississippi, has been confused by, well, there was a real, I would say, a very artistic job of brainwashing that was done on the redneck in Mississippi in 1948. And it was a highly skilled public relations guy, I mean, advertising man named George Godwin, who was among the key strategists in developing the Dixiecrat movement in 1948. And they knew that the only way you could get the Mississippi, I mean, the dyed-in-the-wool Mississippi Democrat to ever leave the party would be to prove to him that the party had betrayed him, you see. So they did a selling job in 48 that it's still in existence now. I mean, the average Mississippian who really wants to be a Democrat is still confused about the Democratic Party. He thinks the Democratic Party left him, you see, and that he didn't leave the Democratic Party. This was the theory under which, you know, the Dixiecrat movement was begun in 1848, and this has been the device. I mean, it's been used with some variations, I mean, in every campaign since then, you see, you know, Ross Barnett in 1960, and then Goldwater in 1964, and then Wallace in 68, and of course, when he got down to 72, they were all set up to vote Nixon, you see. I mean, it's purely a, you know, campaign personalities, which still seems to govern our politics. I mean, personalities rather than there's no more loyalty, you know, to a national party in Mississippi, and this has been undermined by the fact that no national political figures in Mississippi have tried to, you know, reorient Mississippians to the fact that the national Democratic Party is where their salvation is. I mean, economically and on many other questions, and so consequently, if you have nobody, you know, showing or trying to rebuild the image of the Democratic Party as the best friend, you know, of the South, and the best friend of the you know, the benighted Mississippi redneck, why you don't have any, you know, there's no justification then for voting Democratic. So, I mean, what the die that was cast in 48, I mean, it's still, I think, still pretty well governs our politics in Mississippi. I mean, as far as, I mean, national politics.
What is Eastland's role in Mississippi politics?
Well, he is the most powerful single figure in Mississippi politics, no question about it, and has been for years, even though the average Mississippian doesn't even know that. I mean, you have to be someone who's a close student of politics or a journalist, someone like us, who really understand, I mean, how he works and how... all-encompassing, I mean, his political maneuvering is. And he, of course, has not publicly identified himself as supporting the Democratic ticket since 1960. I mean, he identified with Lyndon Johnson and Jack Kennedy, and that's the last time we've ever heard from him.
Was he operated as a somewhat shadowy sort of figure?
By and large, yes. I mean, he certainly doesn't do it through overpowering oratory or charisma, because he has none. I mean, it's done through wire pulling. I mean, this is how he operates. And he has great many politicians in the state, plus business people and others who are obligated to him. I mean, he gets their IOUs, and then he cashes them in as he needs them. And he's used his influence in Washington, you know, to help everybody that he can help. And if help a guy in his income tax trouble, or you help a guy get a business loan or something like that, his business about to go under or something, well, I mean, they don't forget it, at least when.
Now, does his influence extend down into the legislature on state issues?
Sometimes it does, yes. Sometimes he...
Any examples of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the most important change of guard that could have taken place in the legislature occurred after Walter Sillars, who was Speaker of the House and most powerful figure in the history of the legislature in Mississippi. He's been speaker for 26 years and had been a member of the House for 50 years, I believe, and he was a tremendously powerful guy. And when he died, like in 66, I mean, of course, everyone was not prepared, you know, how, you know, whether there's going to be a power struggle or, you know, a change of guard. So, and Eastland apparently did come into the picture to see that the transition was not very cataclysmic. I mean, that the person who took Eastland's place was... Sillars' place was someone highly acceptable to him, and also represented the old guard that Sillars had...
Who did replace Sillars?
John Junkin, J-U-N-K-I-N. He's still the speaker. But he's in very bad health now, and he's been out this session.
What were those interests that Sillars represented, basically?
Well, Sillars, of course, came out of the Delta, and the Delta planter, statesmen, politicians have pretty well run the legislature here since the 20s, anyway, and probably since Vorderman, really, and maybe even before the 20s. And well, Sellers was absolutely, I mean, the gracious old Southerner who was thoroughly convinced that the Democratic Party was the opiate of the masses, and that the he really was one of those who was building the transition to the Republican Party eventually, but he was one of the key people in the Dixiecrat movement, see, in 1948. Well, and of course he represented big business interests and big planter interests and so on. I mean, this is what Eastland was interested in, the same thing, you see. Sellers would be more...
Would it have been more big planter interest and big business interest if the two clashed?
I don't understand you.
I say, if you had an issue in which big business interest and big planter interest clashed, would he have then been representing big planter interest?
Oh, yeah, but I don't think you'd find that. You wouldn't find such a clash, I don't think, in this state. Eastland would be a little bit more liberal than Sellers now. I mean, Eastland was more of a practical, is more of a practical politician, you see. I mean, and he will accept certain things that a Sellers would never accept.
Now, we've been told that almost all the politicians supported Sullivan in 1971 except for Eastland, and that Eastland supported Waller, and that this was a major factor, and that he supported Waller because he really was opposed to Sullivan. Is that basically true?
Well, I wouldn't say all politicians, but I mean, most of the people in the legislature, for example, picked a candidate. I mean, they were for Sullivan, and he had, by and large, I guess, more politician in the state and business interests too. I mean, he had the business interests, and Eastland was through a strange set of circumstances had decided a few years ago that he didn't like Sullivan, and there was really no specific incident or anything that really brought it about, except that Sullivan apparently had made some remarks, and best we can figure out, at some cocktail party or something where he had a good bit to drink or something, and he threatened to run against Eastland one time. Well, that got back to Eastland, and apparently Eastland made up his mind, and that he didn't want Sullivan to get anywhere in Mississippi politics if he could prevent it. And he didn't even know Waller. The first time Waller went up to see Eastland, he never met him before.
Was that when he was a candidate?
Yeah. He went. It was in May of 71, as a matter of fact, and he went up to get anointed. And
what was the effect of that? I mean,
well, you see, I mean, Eastland did not do it openly. His support of Waller was never, they don't brandish this kind of support, you see, out in the open. I mean, how it was done is that Eastland turned loose some of his major sources of political campaign money and made him available to Waller.
That was after this meeting?
Yes.
Do you know how the meeting came about?
Well, Waller, I think, Waller went up to see him. He knew that Eastland was looking for a candidate, and actually Eastland had really halfway endorsed two people prior to the first primary. But when it became evident that Waller was going to be the best chance, then he of course shifted to Waller. But this took place after that. I mean, he did get some of Eastland's, main bankrollers to guarantee enough money to hire this Delos Walker, the agency guy from up at Memphis, who, that turned out to be a real stroke for Waller, because he put on a very shrewd campaign for him.
Is that the first real media campaign ever waged in Mississippi?
Well, no. I've had media campaigns before, but this was, he put on the shrewdest media campaigns that he'd been put on.
Was that the first professionally run media campaign?
I think so, yeah. I would say that. Although there have been some pretty high-priced media people out of Texas that come in here for the Republicans in the governor's race in 63 and 67, and they didn't put on anything nearly as effective. Where Walker was so smart is he didn't have Waller speaking very much, because Waller's a lousy speaker, you know, but he does have a redneck Northeast Mississippi red clay hills twang, you know, but then, which I think people like. I mean, it gives him identity anyway. And but he didn't have him saying very much. He would show a long film with Waller, would say a few words or something like that. Then in the second primary is where I think he played his card really smart, because Sullivan had led the ticket pretty handily, see, in the first primary, and Waller had a heck of a 60-some-thousand vote margin to overcome, you see. And Walker put handled Waller in such a way that they put Sullivan on the defensive immediately, and Waller just didn't say a thing hardly in the second primary, and let Sullivan just sort of just tear himself to pieces.
How do you mean you put him on the defensive?
Well, because Sullivan ran his first primary campaign ignoring all the other candidates, you see, and then suddenly he does an about face in the second primary and starts attacking Waller, you see, and calling for Waller to face him in debates and to come on out and say what he really means, and so Walker just holds Waller back, doesn't answer any of the Sullivan charges, and just ignores Sullivan more or less in the second primary, and it worked beautifully for Waller, because he had Sullivan, firing all these demands for debates and response from Waller, you see, and Waller just wasn't answering anything. It worked out very well for him. And of course, he concentrated on just visual, a lot of visual aids, he just used the Waller's face an awful lot.
How has Waller been as governor?
He's been a tremendous surprise, really. I mean, he has no... he has no really strong convictions, but he has an opinion on everything, and he has a sort of a country boy's fascination for playing with everything that he every facet of state government, and everything's new to him. He has no hang-ups about anything that's gone on before. I mean, it's all brand new to him. He doesn't mind tackling what sacred cows or the shibboleths past. He's challenged the legislature, which is something that's very seldom done. In fact, nobody other than J.P. Coleman, and that's back in the 50s, has really challenged the legislature. The legislative branch of government has been the most powerful branch of government, perpetuated by the old guard of Walter Sillars. And Waller has very effectively challenged the legislature. I mean, the governor course, Mississippi, you know, has a weak governor concept. It's all, I mean, everything is written, even in the state constitution, to limit the power of the governor. I mean, there are numbers of limitations placed on his power by the state constitution. So, I mean, he had a weak governor concept to begin with, and then if, you know, then if the person who occupies the office is sort of lets the legislature push him around, and you have little programs. We've never had governors that really come forward with a program, particularly every time the legislature meets. Waller has broken that pattern. I mean, he's come forward with that. For example, this program, you have a copy of his legislative program, and this is unheard of for a governor of Mississippi to come forward with a, you know, a detailed, lengthy program, controversial in many aspects, at midpoint of his administration. I mean, it just hadn't happened before. And he's talking about things like gubernatorial succession, which is, you know, this has been one of the never lands in Mississippi. I mean, governors have never, I think only maybe one governor in a great many years ever talked about, you know, amending the Constitution to allow himself to succeed himself. And Waller's been, you know, he's been talking about this, and they haven't gotten very far with it in the legislature yet, but he's not through with it yet. The guy has no handles. I mean, it's really hard for the legislature or anybody else to really grab a hold of
him. Has he gotten anything substantive through the legislature?
Well, of course, he takes a lot of credit for a highway program that passed in 1972, a $600 million highway program, and which has not really gotten on the way yet. Not an awful lot. I think he's prevented some things from happening, though. I mean, around here, and I think he's altered a lot of programs that the legislature has put through. He's gotten through a little bit of the little stuff. But I mean, I don't think you find an awful lot of really big programs that you would have to give him credit for. I mean, the highway program, I guess you more or less would give him credit for it, because he did get it financed when it looked like it was not going to be financed.
Was this a bond issue?
Well, it authorizes bonds, but then they had to raise an awful lot of taxes to
raise gasoline taxes?
Yeah.
How much?
Well, they raised the gasoline tax, 1.5 cents, I guess. They raised a lot, number of other taxes that would go along with it. I mean, there was a whole tax package, you see, the gasoline tax, which is one of them. They raised everything, including the beer tax, to pay for the cigarette tax and everything else. And diesel tax, put on a decal.
Well, what are they going to do with the money?
Well, the idea is to build 1,500 miles of four-lane card roads. After the state is lacking four-lane highways other than the interstate highways, and this, the idea is to build these four-lane corridors across the state. And but it's just been real slow. In Mississippi, one of the problems, of course, of every governor is that every other state official is elected independent of the governor, you see. And of course, the legislature is elected independent of the governor, too. I mean, nobody runs on a ticket, you see.
How many statewide people are elected?
Oh, Lord, they have this terribly long ballot, at least 15 state officials are elected. I mean, including highway commissioners. That's what I was getting around to. You see, the highway commissioners are elected by districts, and they're highly independent, and so much so that, I mean, they just don't, they kind of thumb their noses at the governor, you see, and they kind of go about their own business. So he's been having a constant battle with the highway commission, and he's been very critical of it, and has threatened, you know, to get the system changed, but he hasn't had any success with it yet. He hasn't reorganized it. That's just an example of some of the things he has not been able to do. His influence in the legislature, you see, is not too widespread. This is part of the old system here of the governor does not have floor leaders, you know, and whips and people that really, you know, can flag a governor's program through the legislature. They just don't have that. I mean, they have. His influence is sort of done kind of his individual legislators that may go along with it. And he does not have very effective people that are sort of helping him in the legislature now.
How does his administration compare with all the others? The 1948 has more activists and caretakers. Is that some way to describe it?
Yeah, well, no, his is not a caretaker administration. No, I mean, I think he has brought, first thing is, I mean, he's the first governor to ever really bring blacks into any boards, commissions of the state. I mean, first governor, and he has now blacks appointed on some 25 state boards, something like that. And then he has put on. He's the first governor to bring in a black assistant in his office, you know, and on his staff and.
What kind of blacks does he bring in, Bill?
Well, they're not, they're not highly acceptable to the, you know, to the...
Were any of them active in the civil rights movement?
No, in a way, I mean, one of them is Cleve McDowell, for example, who was the second black to enter University of Mississippi, you see, and he was one of the targets of the Ross Barnett period, you know, and Ross Barnett harassed him so much that they finally got him thrown out of school back in the 60s. Well, Cleve McDowell later was able to go ahead and finish his education someplace else, and he has him, for example, on the state penitentiary board. He was at, Waller put people, put a black on the penitentiary board and a parole board, places, you know, that certainly nobody'd ever. And there's been no blacks really appointed on any state board.
You think that's going to be seen as his most significant accomplishment?
I think it will be, yeah. I think he's been a surprise in that score. He's been a surprise on his attitude about the National Democratic Party. He's the first governor since J.P. Coleman to proclaim he is a National Democrat. And he doesn't really quite understand what he's saying, but he says that he is a National Democrat. And of course he made this, I think it was a rather strong effort in 1972 to get recognized and get the regular Democrats, which he had, you see, in Mississippi. I mean, you know, nominally he's the head of, to get them back into the National Democratic Party. And he did undertake, you know, to negotiate with the loyalist Democrats who were recognized by the National Party. Now the negotiations reached, I think, a really significant point. I mean, I think it established the some foundation on which the party's factions can be merged eventually. I mean, I think this is evident that a pretty good foundation was established there. But he had no background we had no idea how he stood on national politics before. He had never been identified with any of the Bolt movements. I mean, he'd not been identified with Ross Barnett's unpledged electoral movement, you know, in 1960, and he had not been identified in the Wallace movement or any of that. But at the same time, he'd never been identified as any kind of National Democrat either.
Am I correct? What he was best known before was as the prosecutor of D. Lake Beckwith
in the
Was that an elected prosecuting position?
Yeah, he was the district attorney for Hinds County, which is this county, and the effort that he put forth in that campaign, in that trial it was pretty widely accepted. I think even by national press and everyone who was here as being a genuine effort.
Has he used a veto more than any other governor?
His veto has been one of the most active vetoes. Yes, he certainly vetoed more pet bills that of legislators than any governor. Certainly, the only one to compare with would be Coleman, and I think he's beaten Coleman on that. And he likes to go at bills, I think, that he knows are going to upset and annoy certain legislators. And by doing this, he keeps them off balance. He doesn't particularly get anything in. There's no quid pro quo, about the thing. But, he doesn't get anything in return, but he gets a satisfaction, I think, of keeping them off balance, and then eventually, I think he's going to get something out of it.
Is this mostly little special interest legislation?
Well,
of a minor nature, or what?
Not altogether that way. In other words, last week he vetoes the a bill to create a trust fund for the revenue sharing money. You see, he's had it in mind ever since revenue sharing money was made available that the governor should determine how the money is spent. The legislature, of course, gets here and they pass the bill to create a revenue sharing trust fund that they decide how the money will be spent. Well, this is the second time he's vetoed a bill to do it. He vetoed one last year and he vetoed one again last week. And he uses all kinds of reasons for vetoing it. The basic reason is that he wants to try to, retain control over the funding. It's being operated now under an executive order that he issued in November of 1972, and it gives him a sort of a little veto power, over how it's spent. And I think he wants to retain it. He and the legislature, go around, I think, about a number of things that... One where the legislature has tried to extend its power into the executive branch of government. It's already extended much too far in Mississippi. Under previous governors, the legislature has gone really headlong into the administrative branch. The executive branch of government. The legislators serve on just a number of boards that are actually in the executive branch of government. So Waller has met him, I think, head on that score. Now, for example, there is a very powerful investigative arm of the legislature called the Peer Committee, which was just created last year. And they had a hard time ever getting Waller to agree to sign a bill create this because it involves the legislative post audit and there is a State Department of audit, you see. All right, so 2 weeks ago he vetoes the appropriation for the Peer Committee just like that.
And
cuts out their funds.
And this veto has been sustained?
The veto was not overridden. And
does that suggest that he's got a fairly strong support in the legislature, the fact that they don't
know.
Why don't they override?
No, he's using the negative power that the governor has. It takes two-thirds. In other words, you have to have two-thirds of he has power equivalent of two-thirds of the legislature, which any governor has always had. And there's some...
But he's got basically at least the support of a third of the legislature.
Well, yeah. Except, now this is where the strange thing about Mississippi legislators is, there's a goodly number of legislators that are just floating somewhere in the middle there that are like that sheep, you see, and they will run in whichever direction where they think the power is. And they have been the ones that the old guard had dominated all these years. Well, suddenly here comes Waller and using the negative power of the veto, and he and a lot of these sheep in the legislature have tripped over on his side. But he has not been able to cultivate them to then take that and build on it, you know, to use that as an affirmative power.
But they perceive him as being strong, and they don't want to cross him. I mean,
that's right. I mean, they're afraid to cross him because they may want something on some of their really personal pet bills, you see.
Do you know if there's any quid pro quo between him and Eastland insofar as running the Eastland seat?
No, I don't think so. Yet, I don't think. I think he will run probably for the Senate when Stennis, unquestionably, I think will step out. I mean, even before he was shot, I think he had made up his mind to do that. But I mean, I think it's just absolutely certain now. And that seat will open up first, and I think that's the one that Waller will run for, because that will come up in 76, you see. And I think he would run for the Senate if something had happened to Stennis when he was shot last year. I think he would have run.
Do you think that Waller is going to get this situation resolved between the regulars and the loyalists this year?
I doubt if Waller could do it. I would imagine that Robert Strauss came in here or had sent somebody some good, clever, forceful mediators. I think it could be settled. Yeah, and I think there's a lot to work with. And I think the trouble with Waller is he's too heavy-handed and he's too he really is not a clever politician, and he's not shrewd, and he's so, and he does not really know, I don't think, the real ground rules of the group. I mean, I think he's really out of his element in the kind of politics that he's playing with there. I think his intentions are, I think you have to give him a certain amount of credit for having good intentions. I mean, and certainly he has risked alienation with the people who elected him, the rednecks in Mississippi. I mean, the fact that he publicly identifies himself as a National Democrat, I mean, that in itself is not highly acceptable, you know, to most redneck Democrats in Mississippi. I mean, because they're not ready to identify with the National Party. And he thinks that Mississippi can really be brought back into the Democratic Party. He's not a good negotiator, I don't think. I don't think he has good people that are representing him in the negotiations. I mean, I think they're
Does he perceive himself as being a potential vice presidential candidate?
No.
He's
the only Southern governor, I think, the time right.
Can we go back to the initial question about the last 25 years? You described a major change in terms of national politics. What do you see in terms of state politics? What's occurred in those 25 years?
Yeah, well, now I think state politics have changed a good bit. I think that you have more professionalism now in politics. I'm talking about in terms of trying to introducing professionalism in the job. Quality of people, I think, with a broader spectrum, I think, has improved considerably. You find very few of the old time really gallus snapping, back slapping kind of and cigar smoking politicians in state government. There are a few. Now, I'm not saying they're all gone by any means, but... And I think Waller's election, I mean, we've been talking about, you have to bring that up as an example, I think, of a, that is a turning point in Mississippi politics.
Or would Sullivan have been a different?
Well, Sullivan was a little more skilled in state government. Sullivan probably would have not been as moderate as Waller. Waller can afford to be more moderate because, he had no labels before he went into office, you see. But the fact that the two finalists in the Democratic primary in 1971 were two people by Mississippi standards, classified as moderate, and who did not employ, the emotionalism of politics of race. And did not take a couple of opportunities of some events that took place during that campaign that they could have really led everybody, I mean, led the people, to the precipice again. I mean, about busing was an issue then, and it was not really raised in the campaign. There was the shooting of the RNA, Republic of New Africa shootout took place right here, right during the campaign. I mean, you could have, raised created a whole new issue out of that. I mean, if tried to, and I think the campaign ran off on rather moderate grounds. I mean, for a Mississippi campaign. So I mean, I think that that represented the change, I think, in style in Mississippi politics. I mean, certainly it was the first time where there was a very conscious effort not to alienate or turn off any black voters, I mean, openly and publicly. The tragedy of the campaign was that the appeal to black voters, though, and the real bid for the black voters, took place behind the scenes too much. I mean, and both sides were scared to, for example, hire blacks in campaign positions where they were visible, and make any real overt bid for the black vote. I mean, it was far too subtle, and too much of it was behind the scene. And maybe at least, I mean, we'll progress some from that point. Statewide.
So it's more professional, and the style has changed. Yeah. Race is not an issue then. It might not be.